Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with the one and only Emile Decoux. Hey. We love when you come in studio, man.
Me too. And we're talking about our favorite subject, movies.
Yes, and movie music specifically.
And movie music,
yes, no, every time you come in, if you hear Emile's voice on TOP, you know that there's an awesome live movie screening with accompaniment from an orchestra coming to town.
Absolutely, starting this Friday.
Yes, so we have three that we want to talk about specifically. We're going to start off Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone on Friday, July 7th, and Saturday, July 8th, out at Wolf Trap. All of these are out at Wolf Trap.
Right.
Explain to me, A, have you ever done the Harry Potter?
My first time doing Harry Potter.
Wow. Okay, what specific challenges? It's John Williams. It's an amazing theme. We all know by heart, but like more on the technical side, what are some
challenges? Well, the technical side with Harry Potter is it's a huge soundtrack, and he writes his movies, especially this movie, like a Wagner opera. And so I'm carrying this music around coming to D.C. for the shows, and it is so heavy. I had to mail half of the music here in advance because it just was, like, incredibly heavy. Just one half of Harry Potter is longer, as far as music, than all of La La Land put together.
Really?
Yeah. So
just
it's
stacks.
Just, it's because there's almost nothing that isn't underscored. And plus, he writes a melody or leitmotif for each character in each situation. So since it's the first movie, he's kind of introducing the characters on screen, but also introducing the music and what is linked with each character.
Explain those leitmotifs. Let's say, for Harry, what does his sort of sound like? Give me the instrumentation.
Well, Harry, he has two themes, more or less, and it's kind of a parallel with The Wizard of Oz, which we premiered in 2006. And watching the film, and I have to sort of remind myself I'm working, I'm not there to be entertained, but it's so hard not to get drawn into the emotion of the moment with the end of La La Land and the end of Harry Potter, because he has these themes come in. Harry's theme is kind of, it's in 3-4, and it sounds a little like a hymn or something, like simple church music, I guess you could say. And the opening thing you hear on the cellos, which is a little tinkly
almost
keyboard,
like
that sounds like
a lullaby kind of a sound. Yeah,
and the opening thing you hear is a sort of magical Hedwig theme. It's on a cellos, which is the sound of, the Sugar Plum Fairy in the Nutcracker.
Oh, right.
So
that's
very
a good
high,
analogy.
Ethereal, and very magical. That's one of the very first things you hear. And he brings Harry's theme in very sparingly. And it's not just Harry's theme. It's Harry's longing for love and longing for family, which he doesn't find with his family since his parents are killed, which he finds in Hogwarts and with his dear friends and his loving professors. And that comes in very sparingly and just at key moments in the story. In the very end, well, I don't want to give it away in case people haven't seen
the movie. I'm sure most of us have seen Harry or read Harry Potter at this point. But
Dumbledore comes to him when he's in the hospital, and he's talking about why he was protected. And it's not because of a spell or a curse or anything. It's just the love of his mother saved him. And then you hear that incredibly tender theme, just like you hear at the end of The Wizard of Oz when Dorothy says,
There's no place
like home, and you hear Over the Rainbow, and be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. And that's what really grabs you. Not just the lines or the storytelling, it's the music. And that's, at the end of Harry Potter, you are so moved, and you could break down in tears. And I hope I don't, because I'll be working and be embarrassing. But
he's on the verge right now. But no, it's true. It's funny with the music that so many of us take that for granted. You know, we remember Dorothy's line, or we remember Dumbledore and Harry. But it's that almost subconscious thing that's sweeping you away, and it's the music. Most of the time, it's the music.
And I saw the film when it first came out. I've seen it over and over again. Then getting these two gigantic tomes of music, I even as a musician, I'm trying to be aware. You know, like you're aware of the film craft and, you know, lighting and this, so how it's made, but you could just get swept into the film. And I just didn't realize how much music there was and how important it is. And there's, I think, maybe 3 minutes here or 30 seconds there in between scenes where there's no music. And otherwise, it's this music from beginning to end. And not just music, it's some of the best film music I think John Williams ever wrote, and some of the best film music that exists. It's very operatic. It goes back also to the time of Max Steiner and Korngold in the old golden age, when you think of...
Steiner did King Kong,
and
Korngold did Robin Hood.
Right, and Steiner kind of invented film music with King Kong, which is somewhat primitive in 1933, but then you look at...
Pun intended.
yes. But then you look at Gone with the Wind, and it's 3+ hours of solid music.
Sweeping score.
And so it's kind of like that type of film writing and that type of sound and music and approach to the orchestra. It's a massive orchestra with three keyboards, huge percussion, two sampled choruses on two different keyboards, but it's on such an epic scale. Man. And just the craft that John Williams uses to bring this idea of magic, which I think is why there are so many pages, because there's an unbelievable flurry of notes that go that sort of surrounds the simple melodies just to create this sort of whirlwind of mystery.
Awesome. Well, we can't wait to see that. We'll get more to, and there's another John Williams one coming up later, but first, first, La La Land La on La Friday, Land. August 4th. We were kind of talking about that. We were kind of, you know, shooting the bull a little before we started rolling about the Oscars and all that. But the fact that less than a year after this came out, I mean, it came out last fall or maybe even December. I saw it in October. I think it came out in December, actually, around Christmas.
Right.
And the fact that here we are just that next summer and we're already doing a live concert along with Harry Potter, Jurassic Park, these classics.
Right.
What does that say about the movie? I mean, that's high praise.
Yeah, and we also had Star Trek Into Darkness less than a year after it was premiered.
Yeah,
it's an amazing thing with these films because I first started conducting at Wolf Trap in 2000 with a sort of pastiche excerpt score movie show of Hitchcock. And that was the only movie concert we did at Wolf Trap for a couple of years. Then we did something else later, but it was very seldom.
Bernard Herrmann stuff.
Yeah, which is great. But now movies and concerts have become this new way of presenting summer concerts, which is great because you attract a whole different audience. I conducted La La Land actually last month in Salt Lake City. It was one of the first performances after the Hollywood Bowl, and we had a huge response. I mean, it's funny how La La Land, even though it was a low-budget film, almost didn't get made for many years, and also another a throwback to the Estelle Rogers, old-fashioned musicals.
And even the French, there's some French musicals, the Jacques Demy ones, I don't know.
Yeah, the Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Yeah.
It's like a real niche film, but it just exploded. And now you have sing-along La La Lands in theaters and the live concert franchise, which is just amazing that people have embraced a new movie and a quasi-old-fashioned premise.
Yeah.
Of films, but I love it personally because I'm from Los Angeles and you love LA also.
I love the movie, man. I love the movie.
And it has such a great heart. The funny thing when I conducted in Las Vegas, which I don't always watch the whole movie, and I hadn't actually seen the movie before because I was too busy running around doing other things. And so I'm just watching the parts that have the songs and then I skip ahead because, there'll be chunks of time or dialogue. I don't need to watch that.
Right.
And so I'm conducting it last month and I'm seeing the film for the first time, and I'm like just burst out laughing at some of these incredibly funny scenes, but also how touching it is. And again, not everybody's seen the film. If you haven't, this is the best way to come and see it because you hear this great live score. But what's most remarkable that really struck me is the very end of the film when you have the film retold in about 5 minutes.
Right, it doubles back on itself, and you see, I guess, what could have been.
Or even just, people remember things in the best possible way.
Right. But what was the Streisand line? What's too painful to remember? We choose to forget,
exactly.
We remember the line. Yeah, so you remember the good stuff.
But I thought that was a stroke of genius, inserting this retelling of the entire story that you've already seen in a totally different way, in this sort of magical French primary colors, bright, cheerful.
Yeah.
And then it ends just with a single piano.
Very bittersweet.
Playing this the Mia and Seb's theme at the very end.
We actually, that must be a great part to play because that's all music there is they're dancing in the stars and stuff at the end.
Oh, yeah.
But we actually interviewed Justin Hurwitz, the guy who won
the
Oscar for the composition. And he was sitting at his piano while we were interviewing him,
so
and I didn't
great.
Know that. So in between, I'd be like, so tell me about Another Day of Sun. He's like, well, this was hard, and then all of a sudden you go, dun, dun, dun. He'd start playing it during the interview. It was insane. But anyway, he said that in that last part, you have the big sweeping music, but then the part you're talking about where it's kind of stripped down at the end, when Sebastian's at the piano.
Right.
The dun, 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 that one.
Right, yeah.
He said that started as a demo.
Interesting.
And that they just fell in love with that raw, vulnerable quality that they left it in there.
Right.
And then I think at the end, right for the end credits, it picks back up, right?
Right.
But tell me about how that whole, the wraparound end that you're talking about, the what could have been sequence, just explain that musically, as you're composing that.
Well, it's tricky in that we have...
Or conducting that.
Well, yeah, because we have the jazz combo. It's a good half of the film is with the jazz quintet, and so that's right in front of me to coordinate the songs. And this is the hardest type of film to do because you're your accompanying singers who are on the film, and they might not start singing for a full minute into the music.
Right.
And so if you're not in within a quarter of a second, then it's out of sync and sounds ridiculous. And also, they recorded it in the studio, and so some of the quieter songs, like City of Stars, it's very free, like you would do in a nightclub. But then we have to recreate all the rubato and the swimminess with live musicians and not knowing what, you know, they're going to do in the next phrase. I mean, of course, I listened to it probably about 20 or 30 times, but that's very tricky. But having this jazz comp in the center and the piano, because it's a story about a jazz musician, an actress, but it's kind of like a jazz piano concerto. Mm. And so he has his own screen, and he has a click track in his ear. So he's watching Ryan Gosling sort of pretend to play the piano because it's syncing with the recording he's hearing.
Right.
And so it's like doubly synced.
Right.
But it's very, very challenging because they'll have close-ups. Remember the film, close-ups on his hand, and he's like flying like crazy up and down the keys, playing scales and arpeggios and chords. And that has to be recreated, you know, to the second because everyone's watching this thing on a huge screen.
Right.
So that's very tricky.
That's got to be hard. That's what I was going to ask you, is are all those parts are more recreated then?
Yeah.
And the only part I guess we're seeing from the movie we already saw was their voices,
Voices. Maybe all the instrumentals are played. And a lot of it is improv'd on the score itself. So it'll say, you know, if you're looking at a saxophone part or a piano part, a trumpet part, it'll just say a chord. It won't even have the notes after a while. For pages and pages, like C major,
so
G7.
even the scenes where me and Sebastian, let's say, go to the jazz club, you're recreating that, trying to match it with those trumpets on screen.
Yeah, because they'll show the trumpet, they'll show the piano. The one thing that's kind of free is when they have their dinner together, and we're basically music on the radio.
Right.
And that's mostly a jazz trio.
In that green
trio.
Light?
Yes.
That vertigo green light?
Yeah, exactly. And that's a little freer because it's supposed to be background music anyway.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, you have to get really top-notch jazz freelancers and jazz improvers, which we have in the symphony and also joining us as guests.
Explain, paint a picture for our listeners. If they haven't seen it or even if they did see it, as we come to Wolf Trap, we're sitting there and all of a sudden, you know, the movie opens and it goes to the widescreen and we have another day of sun on, you know, on the highway.
Right.
What is that like for you guys to kick in there with that bum, 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 ba dum, ba dum, ba?
That is so, it's so thrilling because it's a perfect opening to a movie and a perfect opening to a concert. Because you don't know, if you don't know the story, you don't know what's going to happen. And so, you know, you see this big widescreen, you know, view of this freeway off ramp in Los Angeles and just singing the song, which kind of sets the mood. But also, you realize later, they're all talking about out of work actors and out of work musicians and out of work jazz people. And they're dancing. And the thing I love about the film is that it's telling the story of Los Angeles, because Los Angeles is one of these places that it seems that nobody's actually from. You go to Los Angeles for a reason. You go to Los Angeles to create yourself or recreate yourself or run away. And so it has a magical element to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they wanted to tell the story of Seb and Mia as well, is that it's this place that exists uniquely in the United States or in the world.
In the world, yeah.
It's a set-aside place where people go to do amazing, magical things,
creative,
if you're lucky.
Yeah. And the part that's going to be so magical is when they go to Griffith Observatory.
Yes.
And they're in there, and I can just picture it now with your orchestra on stage, the NSO, where there's that little moment, what is he? He drops the handkerchief, or she does.
Right.
And it goes up into the air, and there's like a little flute or something. And it's like, and then they lift off into the stars.
And it becomes a sort of fantasy ballet.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the first half of the film. I love how they go
there. Oh, that's where you do intermission?
Yeah. And I love how they go there to see, well, not to Griffith, but go to the movie theater to see Rebel Without a Cause, which she hadn't seen. And so we kind of splice. You hear a little bit of the soundtrack of that.
It's a great score.
Oh, it's a great score. And the scene that takes place at Griffith Observatory.
Is them recreating that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh, we could geek out on La La Land forever, but come see it. It's going to be a one-of-a-kind experience.
It's so touching. Surprisingly touching for a modern film, because we're not in that old-fashioned age of, you know, tearjerkers and you know, love stories, but it was
refreshing. It kind of got back to that a little bit, you know?
And it's just about people. It's about love or missed opportunities.
Yeah.
And it has an amazingly great heart.
Yeah. And just come see it outside under the moonlight. See what we did there?
Yeah. And the winner is.
And the winner is La La Land under the moonlight.
And you were
there
backstage.
I was
backstage.
It was absolutely insane to hear Emma Stone and Barry Jenkins and them both coming back and just getting peppered with question after question. It was crazy.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, so then the very next night after that, on Saturday, August 5th. You're sticking in town at Wolf Trap for one of my childhood favorites, Jurassic Park.
Which is about, is it 15 years? Not yet. I think it's like
93. Spielberg and Williams did that the same year as Schindler's List.
Oh, that's amazing.
You dominate the Oscars with one and the box office with the other. That was insane. Yeah. But talk about Jurassic Park.
But also with Harry Potter, he was approached to be the director of Harry Potter. And he wanted to make Harry Potter as an animated film and not as a live-action film. So
and then
he kind of like
Chris Columbus.
Chris Columbus. So he kind
who
of
had
like,
worked with Williams on Home Alone.
Right.
This is all how it's all tied in.
Everyone knows each other.
But Jurassic Park, baby, this score is awesome.
It's an amazing score. I conducted it in San Antonio last year, and we did 3 sold-out shows. And it was so great because I thought the kids would be afraid because the dinosaurs, you know, when they choose up the lawyer.
Really scary.
Kind of,
the T-Rex thing and the raptors at the end, too. That's some of the scariest scenes ever done.
But the kids were great, and they just sing. Yeah. So I always walk around to see who's coming to the show, just to see what our audience is like. And tons of families, tons of kids with dinosaur T-shirts and people, you know, bringing little play dinosaurs. And it's just, they made a whole event of it. And I know our audience is at Wolf Trap will as well.
Absolutely.
But it's a totally different score. It's very different from Raiders, which we did last year, and extremely different than Harry Potter. Mm. And still the same composer. That's what I think is so great about John Williams, is that he is almost like a chameleon. You can always hear his voice, but he can morph into whatever, you know, mood or story he's telling. You think of Catch Me If You Can, which sounds sort of Mancini-like. Mm. Harry Potter sounds kind of Prokofiev ballet music almost. And he wanted with Jurassic Park to write something that the music reflected the awe and the excitement of these scientists seeing these live dinosaurs for the first time. So you don't have so much. I mean, you do have the fast, scary music at the end.
Sure.
But I was really surprised when I was studying the score that the most famous scene, the T-Rex scene with the car chase, is there 7 minutes with no music.
Wow.
Which is a very, very long time. And I thought that would have been the one thing he would just go bananas over and just like have all sorts of crazy, you know.
It's the silence.
It's just
what makes
the silence
scary.
Of it and the scariness of the foot pounding of the T-Rex and then the horrible roar and his face going to the car just in silence.
But that's the genius of it, because if you had this music, you know, competing with the roar, you know.
It'd be too much.
I think that the absence of music sometimes is just as important sometimes.
Yeah.
Explain the two. I know with Jurassic Park, there's almost, I mean, you know the music in and out, but from us just movie watchers, there's almost like two themes that I remember. One is the big Welcome to Jurassic Park, the bum 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 bum, as the gates opening.
Yeah.
And then there's this, I guess, the more slower piano, you know, I guess would be like the main theme.
It's kind of like a hymn.
Yeah. Explain sort of the difference in playing both of those, because they're both legendary themes now.
Oh, they are. You know, they're as famous as anything ever written. And you get the big Welcome to Jurassic Park theme, I think, for the first time when the helicopter is coming over. And they turn and look to where they're landing, and you see this huge waterfall, which is filmed on the island of Kauai in Hawaii, of course.
Yeah.
And then the helicopter goes down, you know, following the waterfall down until they land. And, but you have to hit the cue when I think he says something like, "There it is," and they turn, and then the camera cuts immediately to the waterfall, and then you have to have that theme exactly to the second.
Right.
And the very end of the film, when the T-Rex bites the raptor. And the thing I don't understand is they all think they're going to be killed by these 3 raptors because they surround people. That's how they hunt.
In the little visitor center, right?
Yeah, but how does a T-Rex sneak into the room without them knowing?
Just let it go, man.
But
he
at
comes
one point,
to save the day.
Yeah, he saves the day. And so you see the T-Rex, and when he turns, and you have to get that theme, not when he bites the raptor, but he takes the raptor and flings it into the T-Rex skeleton, which collapses, and that's when
a
you
little
get
bringing up baby right there.
Exactly. But that's when you get the Welcome to Jurassic Park theme at the very end when the dinosaur saves the day.
That's a good point, because early on we hear the rumbles of the T-Rex approaching and the ripples in the water. Why don't we hear it there? We'll give a little creative license.
He sneaks in.
At that point, we're on, you know, you can suspend disbelief.
Exactly, because you have to.
We're along for the ride at that point.
But that's a really, it's a roller coaster ride of a film to conduct, and especially at the end, because it just accelerates. You know, as the drama and the excitement happens, you just like the music gets more and more fervent and very, because it's kind of deceptive, because it starts very quietly with these two themes, like you said, and is there nothing really threatening in either of them until it kind of changes and it gets towards the end of the film And it becomes kind of Hitchcock-like. You know,
absolutely. Once the dinosaurs start eating all... what does Goldblum say? Yeah, but when the Pirates of the Caribbean breaks down, the pirates don't eat the tourists. Oh, it's so great. Everybody come out and see it. All right, cool. Well, in closing, we have Harry Potter, La La Land, Jurassic Park. But just in general, wrapping up, you know, why should they come out if they've never done sort of these movies? They've seen them, but they've never done it in this setting, like live outdoors, you know?
Right.
Why should they come? I mean, well, I think it's, I love doing it. It's a whole new way to experience it.
Well, even if you've seen these films or seen them a lot or seen them in a movie theater, you will never experience them on such a huge screen that we have at Wolf Trap. We have one inside the Filene Center and two outside on the lawn. But to hear the music, to hear the detail that these composers and orchestrators put into this, Jurassic Park was written relatively quickly. It was orchestrated by two orchestrators, one of them being Alexander Courage, who is most famous and remembered for writing the theme for the original Star Trek television series.
Mm-hmm.
So you had
Gene Roddenberry,
And so he worked on the orchestrations, but I'm just looking at the score and studying it like I would study a piece by Tchaikovsky or anybody. And you look at how much detail. You'll have, you know, obscure instruments, alto flute or something very low, very quiet, and you'll have two of them to make a certain color, a certain mood. And when you're watching the film at home or in a movie theater, it gets obscured with all the other sounds and the dialogue and the special effects. But only at Wolf Trap with these types of film concerts, you can hear absolutely every detail that these people lavished hours and hours and hours, and these musicians in the studio, to hear it the way they heard it in their head.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, you know, when I'm traveling a lot, I mostly watch films on my phone or on the back of a screen on an airplane. And that's like incredibly small. This is like seeing it in the old-fashioned drive-in theaters I used to go to with my folks.
As it was supposed to be.
That's
right?
The way it was meant. Larger than life.
You said something interesting, and that's a perfect place to leave it, is that it's crazy to think that all of this was in someone's head. They thought of all of these little variations.
Yeah,
that's
insane. And this ultimate detail and care. Like even the cyclone scene in The Wizard of Oz, which you can only hear half of it. And when we premiered it in 2006, because there's all the wind and noise. And I look at, like, somebody spent a month writing this four-minute sequence and orchestrating it with such care, and half of it you can't hear. And I thought people heard this for the first time in 2006 at Wolf Trap, aside from the people who recorded it in Hollywood.
Wow.
Between that time, you couldn't hear the music.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So that's why we keep doing these shows.
And
thanks so much for coming in.
Okay, thanks so much.
It's a treat every time.
Well, for me too.
All right, well, we'll see you at Wolf Trap.
Okay.